The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets. My name is Paul Hill, and by popular demand, I'm delighted again to be able to speak to Stuart Whittleston of Odessian Capital, one of the UK's finest investors. So welcome, Stuart.
Morning, Paul.
Yeah, well, you've had a cracking time over sort of the last two or three years, certainly. And the markets actually in the US have had remarkably pretty strong, actually, in the first half. But given interest rates are likely to stay higher for longer, at least for another sort of 6 months or so, what's your sort of outlook broadly for equities, and particularly in your sort of like your sweet spot of sort of mid and small UK caps?
Well, I think short-term forecasts are always notoriously unreliable. I think our view has consistently been, when we look back in 3 or 4 years' time, now would have been a really interesting time to be getting a bit more market exposure. There'll be some bumps on the way. I can't see a significant re-rating of equities until flows into the asset class change and flows for those your listeners or viewers who look at this, flows into UK funds generally pretty dreadful at the moment. And that means there's more marginal sellers than marginal buyers. And therefore, basically, the valuations these companies are really generally being sort of pushed quite down. So something needs to change. Now, interestingly, Ed and I have been speaking to a number of existing and potential holders over the last, we're constantly talking to people, but interesting in the last 3 or 4 weeks, people are starting to look at the UK again and say, actually, we know this is really cheap. We can see it's cheap. It's cheap in absolute terms. It's cheap, particularly relative to some of the big cap US stuff. But what's the catalyst? What's going to change? The challenge is, when you realise what the change is, if you're not already positioned, you've already missed some of it. So it's very much, we think, a game of patience. Within the market, I think there's going to be much more winners and losers. I think any company that's got a lot of gearing that thought it could refinance on interest rate of exits. It's a bit like everyone who's got a mortgage, right? If you've got to refinance in the next 6 months, you know your mortgage is going to cost you more money. And that's going to have an impact on the equity value of your house. And it's the same for stocks. So I think there's going to be quite a big change there. I think the other big thing that we talk about is there aren't that many value managers left in the UK. In fact, we just had a client and just now talking with us about this. And in small cap, there's Aberforth, there's Teviot, there aren't that many other people left. And part of that's because so much money has moved towards growth momentum investing over the last decade. And those funds got very, very big. But reallocation away from those funds is a bit like a super tanker. It takes time to turn things around. But we think it will. And if you go and look back at the aftermath, the dot-com boom, small cap value did really, really well, really, really well. So I think there's going to be a style change coming, in the next year or two in terms of what really moves markets.
Mm. Oh, and just in terms of that, the sort of the flows out of small and mid caps, you raise a sort of fascinating point that I know investors would be interested in. Where is that money going? So you get fund redemptions, et cetera. I know yours isn't because it's closed. It's a closed fund, et cetera. But you get a lot of these open sort of OEICs, et cetera, which are sort of like lose some money, et cetera. Where is that money going? Is it going into sort of the big caps or into growth or into sort of effectively into money market funds?
At the end of last year, it's dynamic. At the end of last year, we were told by various wealth managers that there's this big push towards global equities away from country specific. And if you've got your pension or your money with one of the wealth managers, over the last 10 years, they've probably sold more UK equities, bought more US equities. Last year, UK equities outperformed the first time in a long time. Reaction of most wealth managers was to top-size UK equities, which are still cheap, and buy more US equities that are expensive, because that's what their asset allocation models attain them. So something needs to change. So there's move out of UK to global equities. The other thing at the moment is, the returns you can get on gilts are pretty interesting. So the risk-free rate effectively is going up, and therefore the return you want from taking on more risky equities is higher. So there has been, I suspect, an allocation away from equities towards higher yielding fixed income and certain bonds. So effectively, if interest rates start to ameliorate and people think growth is going to come back, people will probably sell bonds and buy equities.
Right.
Who knows when that's going to happen? It might be end of this year, it might be next year. Who knows?
Yeah. One flow in, which you've benefited pretty well since. I mean, we only spoke sort of 6 months ago, but you've had Curtis Bank, Hive, and Devro all been bought out.
Yeah.
How do you stick to that general sort of M&A theme? It's sort of like as the sort of the tide goes out, investors sort of move their money. The sort of professional, sort of like, you know, sharp, serious guys come in and pick up the beautiful sort of like, you know, your quality small and mid caps.
No, I think when there's lots of mispricing, I think where we differ from a traditional value fund is we're particularly looking for companies that if the market doesn't value them properly, somebody else will. Mm. So they don't have poison pills. And because Ed and I worked in private equity, we have a pretty good view of what assets PE houses are like. So we have been surprised by the level of private equity activity in bids this year. We thought it would taper off. Anecdotally, PE houses are starting to draw their horns in because the debt's just become a lot more expensive. You know, they've had years and years of borrowing money very, very cheap to do buyouts. For them to look at a take private now, they have to have an existing asset in the portfolio that offers cost synergies. Straight take private is just not going to work. And we're hearing that through the market at the moment. In terms of corporate M&A, we think that it's going to be quite quiet until the autumn, probably end of this year. People want to see how bad the recession that everyone's been talking about for a long time, how bad is it going to be? What companies are going to be infected? And also how price elastic demand for companies' goods and services are. So, you know, if you're impressed the other day, we've had a number of companies that put pricing up and held volumes. If you get something like Hotel Chocolat that warned the other day, they said, oh, you know, we've found out that our products aren't as price inelastic as we thought and demand's fallen off quite a bit. So people just want to see how that's all going to pan out.
Yeah, okay. So there might be a bit sort of cautious in the sort of the near term. I did notice actually they got an IPO this morning. There was it was Cab Payments, wasn't it? About the first one on the LSE. Hopefully that's a one data point doesn't make a trend. So I won't sort of like be throwing out the bunting yet. But it was interesting. Nothing else. Now, can you just talk quickly your sort of initial thoughts on sort of regenerative AI at all? Because that's been a huge theme, obviously, with the Magnificent Seven out in the States. But I think a lot of investors are sort of get the positives. It's sort of like which companies potentially, you know, sort of like could get impacted. And let's start off with Essential, because I know we talked about that last time. It basically does sort of like, you know, data analytics. It does sort of conferences in sort of, you know, sort of B2B media, etc. And I know it was a sum of the parts. It was a sort of like an unbundling play, I think, last time when we talked about it.
No, absolutely. And they're in the process of unbundling at the moment. It's quite well documented. They're auctioning their main asset called WGSN at the moment. Mm. We don't see that as particularly impacted by generative AI. Their exhibitions business, B2B, in fact, Ed and I went to the Money 2020 conference in Amsterdam a couple of weeks ago. It's difficult to see how that's going to be negatively impacted by generative AI. And the digital commerce business is actually something that effectively uses AI to help big brands sell things more effectively on platforms such as Amazon. So we don't see that as being in the firing line and probably a beneficiary of that. Mm. I think if you look at RWS in the portfolio, this is a translation services and software company.
Yeah.
Well, it's been doing its own language AI for a long time. And if there are two types of AI around translation, there's the stuff you can get on Google that everybody can access, and then there's basically the private world. And the thing about language translation technology is, if you use, you know, if you're, I don't know, you're a pharma company and you've basically want to patent your drug for, you know, curing cancer, you're never going to use Google.
Right. Really?
The reason why is it was actually.
Yeah, no, I get it.
What I understand, the IP actually becomes Google's.
Oh, really? Oh, okay. Right. Okay. I thought it was basically just correctness, because when you put a patent in, you spend so much money. The last thing you want to do is to get the actual terminology wrong. So somebody later down they can actually copy your, the formula. Yeah.
Or if it's private, you know, you're not going to do that. Yeah. And you lose control of the content, particularly if it's open source like ChatGPT. So there's always going to be a need for sort of, you know, basically private language tech. The second thing is actually, if you look at the language services provision, if you're Coca-Cola and you want to organize multi-language campaign for, I don't know, the next World Cup, you tend to use service providers because they do it for you and it's a hassle. So I think there's a big, you know, the actual physical translation is only one part of it. What AI will do is help them be more efficient, so the cost per word will come down. Mm. And we think RWS is actually potentially quite much better placed than its broader peer group because it has this tech stack. It has its own language translation model in there, technology, whereas many other peers are actually just services companies.
I can't believe how cheap it is, actually, because it's got a rock-solid balance sheet. It's got about 50-odd million of cash, and it's trading at less than 10 times PE.
Yeah, I mean, the market has really, really given up with the stock. And we think it's the baby being thrown out of the bathwater. Mm-hmm. Interesting, I don't know if you've seen in the recent results, they've announced a buyback.
Oh, have they? No, I didn't see it. No, okay.
Yeah, so
use some of that cash.
Yeah, so and I think there has been a general view amongst the register that, you know, it's an important sign to show everyone's confidence in the long-term future of the business and the fact they think they can net benefit from what's happening in technology.
Yeah. What about Wilmington? Because this one does sort of like data information, education and trading for sort of like, you know, your global government risk and compliance. It's sort of like high value safety data and presumably training for people. Again, it seems rock solid balance sheet, trading at less than 14 times PE, which again is very reasonable for this sort of high quality asset.
Yeah, and it's got net cash, so the ex cash PE is quite a bit lower than that. Absolutely. So again, we have a couple of companies in our portfolio that we thought might be impacted by AI. We've talked to all of them. The general view, the Wilmington management team is probably, you know, they can't see much negative impact from generative AI. It's probably more positive, helping productivity, and also their training business is a virtual business anyway. So we know if anything, it's probably positive. It's a slight tailwind for them rather than a headwind.
How do you actually, just more generally, how do you decide about, you know, you've got a business, and I know it's sort of case by case, but how do you decide whether it's going to be positively or negatively sort of impacted by regenerative? Is it the sort of the uniqueness of the propriety lot of the data stack, or the something just different that can't be copied, as in like just by scraping the internet?
Yeah, absolutely right. So if you look at quarter of the data that Wilmington does, it is proprietary data. It's data they pull together themselves that is difficult to get from elsewhere. Yeah. I think I heard Nick Train speak the other day about RELTS, and it's very, very similar for them. Mm. And actually, they, you know, certainly his strong belief was that, you know, your wall around your business or your moat is this proprietary data. Mm. And actually, if you've got better processing technology and analytics, you can do even more with that data. Yeah. So it does become a beneficiary. If you're just scraping data off the internet that's publicly available, AI is probably going to do it much better and much cheaper.
Yeah. No, that's and a good rule. That's a really good rule of thumb, actually, for investors, is that it gives you that moat, doesn't it? If you've got the data, then therefore no, people can't copy it. So, yeah, that's pretty good. Now, in terms of sort of like turning to animal and healthcare, let's start with Spire Healthcare, which is a private sort of hospital operator in the UK. I think it's got about 40 sites, et cetera. Now, given my dad is a customer of it and is changing his hips and his knees and my stepmother's doing likewise, I'm guessing these guys, the car parks are full with patients at the moment, sort of waiting for their operations.
Absolutely. And my mum as well, just had in Parkway in Solihull.
Okay.
Yeah, so again, we've had a sort of mystery shopper experience there.
Very good, by the way. My dad would definitely go back.
No, she was very, very happy. No, look, I think, look, there's the obvious issue about waiting lists going up in the NHS and also the time you wait. So I know people that can't afford to go privately, and the waiting time for a knee or hip is months and months and months and months. So I think... and if you look at Spire's business, about 50-odd% of it is private healthcare. Mm. Private healthcare penetration is going up at the moment. 25 to 30% self-pay, and the balance is NHS work. So the prospects look really, really good. The demand's there. I think they're still eating into a backlog of people from COVID as well.
Sure they are, yeah.
The really interesting thing about that business is it's probably one of the least recognized transformation stories over the last 5 years. New Chief Exec came in about 5 years ago, changed virtually the whole top management team, and they've really started to take what was 40 or 50 different individual hospitals, as you described, that were doing their own thing and actually try and get much more value out of it. Right. So, and it's being run like a commercial business with high customer service rather than effectively driven by people and not that business focused. Mm. So lots of things have changed. You can, you know, rather than having to go into the hospital and maybe do some of your pre-operation stuff, a lot of it you can do online now. You know, there's just a load of ways they've improved the business. Mm. From a cost perspective, the it's quite interesting. We were quite big believers that inflation would be much higher than people thought 2 years ago. And one of the benefits that Spire has is it's quite asset heavy. So it owns all of its own freehold property, which in rising inflation is actually a really good thing. Mm. But what we think next year is the real kicker for earnings, because the private healthcare insurers only put their pricing up every 12 months. And then it's backwards looking on inflation. So if you think inflation's probably going to tail off towards the end of this year, their price negotiation next March will basically be based on the previous 12 months to March. So actually you're going to have quite a tailwind, we think, from pricing, just as costs are coming down.
Yeah, no, I would agree. I mean, my dad is a sort of pay-as-you-go sort of like, so you get more pay-as-you-go. But in the insurance side, what's really interesting actually is the US large healthcare insurers are all saying their claims are going through the roof. And I bet the same thing is happening in the UK on the private sort of like, you know, insurance, because, you know, people who have got cover are now using it. They're just thinking fab.
Absolutely. And again, the proportion of people with PMIs, private medical insurance, is going up as well. Yeah. So I think the outlook of that business is really good. They've got a number of things they want to do to expand service lines as well. Mm. You know, we think it's a really good asset.
Yeah, and the shares actually have ticked down as well, just of late. So like everywhere else has as well. So yeah. Just seemed to be a nice one. Now another one which has got a sort of like a perennial sort of transformation, animal care, sort of like benchmark. Now this one does sort of like. I think it's sort of ingredients and health and nutrition and stuff for sort of seafood, particularly salmon and all that kind of stuff. What's your sort of latest view on this one? Because it's currently shares about 40p, and I think it's been about 40p for as long as I can remember.
Yeah, it's oscillated up and down a little bit, but absolutely right. I mean, the challenge with this one for institutional investors is there's very little free float. Right. So the top three shareholders own 20 to 25% each.
Yeah, okay.
So, and there was some question mark whether or not they'd be moving to a full listing in Oslo. So they're dual listed now on Euronext and on AIM. And it's possible that the full move to Oslo won't happen. But this uncertainty has meant that not many UK institutional investors have been willing to look at it.
Yeah.
Because a lot of them can't own Norwegian listed stock. And then on top of that, if you want to buy, good luck trying to find some liquidity. Yeah, okay. So I think it's a bit stuck. From a fundamentals perspective, again, new management team went in 3 and a bit years ago. They've done a fantastic job putting a lot of disciplines around capital allocation in. It had a bit of a wobble during COVID. That part of the end demand is driven by consumption of seafood, which itself quite often is driven by eating out and going on cruises and things like that. So their markets were quite tough. They've recovered quite well. And the business is much better placed, we think, to deliver shareholder value, and it has been for quite a long time. Market's not recognised it. Again, some of Bart's discount opportunity as well. So the three divisions, there's advanced nutrition, largely for salmon and shrimp. There's basically a salmon genetics business, which basically produces disease-resistant eggs. And there's a third business, which is Clean Treat, which is a next generation sea lice treatment product and service. So quite three businesses, which, you know, there is some merit in having them all together, but equally, you could probably find different buyers for all of them. Yeah. So, it's going to be quite interesting. We think either potentially, you know, one of the Norwegian shareholders might decide to buy the whole business, or alternatively, the business gets broken up.
Yeah. Oh, well, I mean, no doubt about it. The price of salmon in supermarkets has increased significantly over the last 3 or 4 years. So margins should be able to recover if you can get that sort of synergy value. Now, just turning to all things cybersecurity and defence, NCC. Now, my antennae pick up when I see a quality stock in this sort of like cybersecurity area that falls so fast, so quickly, and has got GARP sort of characteristic. It does NCC. It does basically cyber security, but also has got a software escrow business that is a bit of a sort of like a total cash cow, etc. Give us your latest view on this, because I just frankly cannot believe the shares have come down so far. It's less than £1 now.
Yeah, so no neither can we. We had it was a reasonably sized investment for us at the end of March, and had a profit warning the last day of the quarter, which is every fund manager's nightmare, because there's nothing you can do about it. And that profit warning was driven by part of their cybersecurity business, which was providing heads into the big US tech companies. And as some of your viewers might recall, in about January, February, March, there was quite a press about the Googles, the Metas, et cetera, laying off staff for the first time in a long time. And these guys were just caught in the crossfire. And I don't think the board anticipated it happening, and you know, sadly, neither did we or other shareholders. Otherwise, hence, you wouldn't have had the sharp move in the share price. And it happened quite late in the company's financial year, so their ability to redeploy staff was quite limited. Now, that's only one part of their cybersecurity business. The bulk of their cybersecurity business, or much larger proportion, is outside the US, in markets that aren't impacted by what's happened in the big US tech companies. I think they said their government's cyber businesses are growing at 25 to 30% a year. Mm. And they've got another business within cyber, which is effectively managed services business, where effectively it's much more recurring revenue and higher quality earnings. So the market's taken a very dim view of cyber in general and the whole company. The shares, I think, at the trough were about 80p. Mm. You're absolutely right. They've got this software escrow business as well, and we think that's worth potentially 70p a share alone.
Yeah.
So if you look at the valuation that was being ascribed on the cyber business at the troughs, it was like, I don't know, 30 or 40 million pounds for a company that has 250 million of revenue. That's just wrong, right? Yeah. So then we looked at it and said, actually, if you strip out the managed services part of that, that's probably worth 50 to 60p. So you're getting a just for the managed services part in the escrow, you're getting, you know, £1.20, £1.30 a share. And effectively, you know, there's a massive negative value on 200 million of cybersecurity consulting revenues. And that just feels wrong.
And you'd have thought the cybersecurity sort of like consultancy will perform better given that you're sort of like the, you know, generative AI, because the amount of deep fakes which are currently online, then, I mean, it makes that job so much harder, doesn't it?
Well, the threats are not going away. Mm. What they've been caught with is too much. You know, they were caught with a very hot US market that probably everyone thought was going to continue and then suddenly stopped. And it's a case of reallocating people into other markets and areas where actually demand is still pretty buoyant. So we see it as a bump in the road. Really interesting. You know, we like people who eat their own cooking. The chairman just bought £500,000 worth of stock, which is a lot of money in anyone's terms. And he, you know, if you his history, he sorts businesses out and he sells them.
Good. Okay. Well, that's you just proved to me that it's definitely a value play rather than a potential value trap. That's for sure. Yeah. Cross fingers.
Caveat emptor and all that. But.
Yeah. I don't want to. That's right. Yeah. I don't. The famous last words. Now, Chemring has obviously done pretty well over the last 2 or 3 years. I know we chatted about it a couple of times, but it does sort of like, you know, in defense, flares and decoys for helicopters and airplanes and stuff like that, presumably, you know, with Ukraine and Russia, and probably out, there's probably the same sort of like aircraft and decoys probably used out in Asia as well. But it's also got a very interesting rogue cybersecurity business as well, which is flying, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think if you remember, we'd actually sold out of the stock last year on the back of the puff around Ukraine.
Yeah.
But we've recently rebought back into it because the shares have been pretty weak, actually. Mm. And we think that, look, you're absolutely right. We think Roke's a fantastic business. It's probably not worth the whole of the market cap now, but it's, you know, that we think the company's trading on quite a big sum of parts discount again. Mm. And interesting, actually, on the non-rogue side, they've just announced a 90 million capex plan to expand a number of their facilities because they can see the demand coming through. Underlying demand is going to be much higher, I think most people think, for the energetic side than and the countermeasures than it has been in the previous decade. And then there's a massive restocking exercise that needs to go on.
Yeah.
So,
course, yeah.
So I think the trading prospects of that business look pretty good over the next 5 to 10 years.
Yeah. I would
and,
agree.
You know, I think the real debate is how well Roke sits together with the countermeasures business. And I think that's going to be an interesting debate for shareholders and the board to have over time.
Yeah, it's probably got commonality of some sort of the customer base, but the technology is different, isn't it?
and the purchase point is quite different as well. So the rating that you put on those two businesses is probably very different, quite different growth profiles, different type of investors that be interested in them. So I think it's going to be, look, my gut feeling, 5 years' time, the business won't look how it is today.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the advantages of you and Ed being on board is you're sort of like active investors and you can probe and challenge management to various different options and scenarios, so which is marvellous. Now, just moving to industrials, the whole sector actually has been flattened this year. Let's start with Elementis, which basically does sort of like ingredients and for deodorants and coatings like thickers and thingers, and also for sort of like, you know, talc and chromium. And I think it sold its chromium business last year, but the crown jewel I think you mentioned last time was a mine or something for talc or something like that.
Yes. So it's unusual because it's a specialty chemicals business. It also owns a big proportion of its own raw materials. It's got the talc mines in Finland, and also the world's only commercially viable and highest grade hectorite clay mines in I think it's sort of Arizona or California.
Yeah.
Truly. And if you're vertically integrated in an inflation environment, it's fantastic. Really, really good because you control your own costs from a raw materials perspective. And they've been incredibly successful at putting price increases through over the last few years. At 3M markets, really, they tend to focus on. They put ingredients into to paints, basically coatings, industrial coatings or decorative coatings. The market's a little bit concerned about how that's going to hold up, particularly in the US at the moment.
Yeah.
The other areas, personal care products, so cosmetics and creams and antiperspirants, demand should hold up pretty well. And in fact, in certain parts of the world, you know, we think demand's actually recovering. They've also got significant cost savings coming through there because on the antiperspirants and cosmetics side, they've closed one of their sites in the States and effectively have changed production to India, where they've built a brand new plant which has the lowest cost production in the industry. And that, we think, saves probably $15 million or so of costs this year.
Right.
That's a big cost tailwind.
Yeah.
The final division is the talc business, and that had a really, really tough 2022. One of the end markets is automotive, and automotive production in Europe was quite weak last year, and they had destocking, and also they were hit by energy costs going up in that business. So that business made no money last year. Historically, it's done $25 million of EBIT. Mm. So that's a massive swing on profitability for the group. We think it's probable that comes back, and there's very little in forecast for that, we think, at the moment. So lots of moving parts there. We look at it and say, well, I think the price to book at the moment is sub one. Over the last 10 years, the average has been 1.8. So from a fundamental value perspective, the company is probably under earning. It's got some parachutes or some things to compensate for slightly weaker top line. But actually, valuation is assuming a pretty negative scenario. Had two bid approaches 2 years ago.
Yeah, I was going to say
trade bars. Yeah,
yeah.
Bit of optionality there.
It's got to be a crown jewel in the UK, trading at just over 12 times PE, so on trough earnings.
Yeah, and a lot of people saw the premium chemicals division as a poison pill.
Yeah,
and that's gone.
Yeah,
absolutely gone. So. Gotcha.
Another one which has been sort of through the ringer in the industrial sector is Flowtech Fluid Power, slightly smaller, about 60 million market cap, got a bit of debt, but it does sort of like distributor and does services for all things sort of pneumatics and fluid power type of, you know, sort of valves and stuff like that, distributes to companies around the UK. It's trading on roughly around about just over, well, about 8.5 times PE for this year on probably, again, quite low earnings. And it's sort of struggled to increase its return on capital employed. What's your sort of outlook for this business? Because, again, it hasn't yet been able to transform itself.
No, I think that's right. I think the since we last spoke, the news there has been a change of chief executive. So Bryce had been there for quite a long time, has handed over the reins to a
Mike
guy
England,
who's come,
isn't it?
Yeah, that's right, from who's come from Electro Components, where he was a group COO. So a very, very highly qualified guy to take on the baton from Bryce. And I think if you look at RS Components in particular, their online capabilities are fantastic. So the hope is that Mike, coming from a company that's been through that transition, can really help Flowtech, I guess, turbocharge what it's looking to do on the online side, which has probably taken a bit longer than I think all the investors had hoped. Look, the other thing is, Paul, it's really suffering from the size of the market cap, sub 100 million. There just aren't that many people interested in buying these things at the moment. And the you know, once you drop below 100 million, the number of potential buyers falls even more. So, you know, we still think there's a lot of value there. Ultimately, it's a consolidating industry. I think there's some things that Mike can do to help short-term and medium-term performance. Let's see where this one goes. The as well as the self-help, I think suspect people might be a bit worried about the UK, the impact of the UK recession on the company. Who knows what that looks like? And is it consumer recession? Is it industrial recession? No one really knows. So I think it's understandable that maybe at the moment, you know, it's a bit friendless. But we still see lots of potential value there.
Yeah, well, they've got a good guy at the top, then it can definitely make a transformation, no doubt about it, over a certain set time. And I do take your point on the liquidity, because I try to buy some shares in a billion-pound company, and I was struggling. Liquidity going in is awful, but getting out is even worse. So,
well, I think that's quite interesting. I mean, we mentioned a couple other companies on here. We've managed to pick up quite big stakes in Gooch & Housego and James Fisher over the last year.
Okay, right.
And, you know, these are companies that now you can't find any stock. And we've ended up buying 8% of Gooch & Housego in a couple of blocks. We bought 5% of...
It's just discussed Gooch & Housego. What's sort of like interest you there? Because they do sort of like a really advanced photonics, don't they, which go into sort of like... industrial applications, medical, and all this sort of stuff. And I've never really got my head around what they actually do and what's the sort of the investment case.
Yeah, so the technology they have is really all around optics and electronics, the combination of those, which you say is called photonics. And they make components and subsystems that go into machines that effectively use that, or alternative their components for... subsea fiber couplers for telecoms cables. So everybody probably today, right now, is a user of Gooch & Housego's equipment, because they're the largest provider of these fiber couplers that take the cables to and from under the sea. They also are used in industrial lasers, laser-based medical machinery. And when they look at the optics in particular, their USP might be the coating they put on the optical thing that allows them to go, you know, IR, so you can see, you know, defense application, you can see through fog effectively. So lots of really niche areas, and it really is a collection of niches. The opportunity, you know, I've known this company many, many years. I was an investor just over a decade ago. Ed and I have been looking at it for 5 years, waiting for an entry point. And they had a pretty tough period in 2022 because of supply chain issues. And they were really some supply chain issues and probably some difficulties with their own operational management. And they ended the year last October with slightly disappointing results, but with a massive overdues and big order book. They're underperforming on margin. New chief exec's come in. He put his strategic review out last month, and he's targeting medium-term operating margin in the mid-teens. It makes about 9% today. We were in for about 0.9 times EV sales, which, if they can get to 15% margins and grow quite nicely, looks a pretty undemanding entry price. I think the long-term EV sales is two times EV sales.
Yeah.
So again, you know, we thought it was a really good opportunity, but again, it was, the shares were very friendless. Now apparently there's lots of, you know, there's a number of buyers trying to buy stock. Good luck.
You know? Yeah, well, I can imagine somebody will put the slide rule over them as well to sort of like, if private equity, I mean, again, it's a sort of crown jewels. Now, what about sort of like just mentioned James Fisher, which does all things sort of services to the marine sector, which is actually having a bit of a boom with oil and gas and with offshore wind and stuff like that. So what's your sort of like your view on this business? Roughly around about 200 million market cap. It's got quite a chunky amount of debt, about 145 mil. Mm. That may include some of the leases, I'm not sure, but... what's your view on this one?
So this was one of our higher risk, higher return investments that we looked at last year. So some of the listeners might be familiar with, it was a go-go stock for very many years. They did lots of acquisitions, but it's probably fair to say there were lots of acquisitions, but maybe not so much integration. And if you pick up the annual report, there's two pages of active subsidiaries, many of which get audited. And they're all subscale, and there's a big job to be done of simplifying and taking cost out. The company had also moved away from a relatively asset-light business model to buying a number of quite asset-heavy business lines, particularly around offshore ships, basically.
Yeah.
So the business model changed, and they geared up to do that, and they got themselves in trouble with the balance sheet. So we looked at it last year and thought, well, actually, no one wants to own the stock. It's on 60% of book value. Yes, it's quite geared, but they have lots of options to get themselves out of trouble. And they made three quite significant disposals at the end of last year, which has alleviated the pressure on the balance sheet. And also they've rebanked as well, which is critical. The real opportunity from now is margin improvement. You know, as you say, they've got lots of tailwinds of growth coming through for their own markets. But the company makes about 6% operating margin. The management team's initial target is to get the margins 10%.
Right.
And they see that as a start. And 10% operating margin would be 15% return on capital. And that would probably be a high teens return on equity. Even though the shares have done pretty well, they're still trading in book value. And if you can get high teens ROE, the company should be trading probably at two times book.
Right. Okay.
So we've done all right. I think we've done all right with the refinancing and effectively the balance sheet repair that's been done. Yes, they need to pay a bit more debt down, but if the management team get the business really humming, you know, there's still a pretty good upside to be had there.
Right. We think. Yeah. And then another one on the industrials is, which I think is a German or Austrian business, is Stabilius, which does sort of like hinges, and it has a sort of dominant market share, I think you mentioned last time. For spring, you know, for cars and off highway and all kind, and also medical, I think for hospital beds.
That's right. So the legacy product is basically gas springs. Yeah. So when you open the bonnet in your car, most cars now the bonnet goes up and stays up automatic. Whereas when I was a nipper, we had a sort of a rod that you had to go and put up to keep your bonnet up. Mm. So that the gas spring is what keeps it up. It helps hatchback, you know, lids close. If people got an SUV with a middle row of seats, quite often the gas spring's there to help you pull the seat up as well. The company's got exposure to the automotive market and industrial market. The real growth in automotive has come from what they call their Powerise product, which is if you've got an SUV or a estate car with a power boot, it's the mechanism that when you press the button, the boot goes up on itself. Yeah. And the unit value of that is 10x what it is for a normal gas spring. So that's, you know, even if the auto market's flat, penetration of Powerise is going up, so the company's growing off the back of that. The industrial business, again, it's a market leader. The automotive business has, I think, a 70% global market share in gas springs. It's the biggest by a long way, and it owns that market. In Powerise, it's got about 35-40% market share. Right. In industrials, it has low market shares, but it's the leader in a much more fragmented area. So, putting pricing up has not been a problem for this company at all. I think the market's nervous about general industrial demand, but we think over the long term, it's a fantastic company. There's a couple of, it's unusually for a German company, it's got an absolutely clean register. There's no family shareholder owning 35-40%. And there's some really, it's a global business. You know, there's some very interesting US peers that are much bigger with big balance sheets. So, wouldn't surprise us at all if one day we woke up and rather than it still being cheap, it belongs to somebody else.
Yeah, it does look like a total category killer, and it's trading on about 13 times with a very strong balance sheet. So yeah, good one for the long term for investors to have a look at. Now, another one in sort of the industrial side, digital inkjet printer technology, Czar. This is something that's been around for ages, and I think it's got a new, well, it's got quite low operating margins at the moment, but has always struggled to get above that sort of like low single digit. What's your sort of view on this one? Because it's sort of like confused investors for just ages.
Look, I think this is a management story here.
Yeah.
The current team went in early 2019 to basically totally changed the commercial strategy and refocused back on the original bulk inkjet market where they where they've been so successful in the ceramics end market, and said rather than trying to diversify elsewhere, let's just go and find other bulk inkjet markets we can address other than ceramics, and basically use our existing technology and tweak it for those markets. And they are towards the latter end of launching a whole bunch of new products into these markets, such as textiles, which was launched at the end of last year, and wide format graphics, which is next year. And these basically increase the addressable market very, very significantly for the company. The key difference with their technology is the fact they can print with very, very viscous liquids compared with any other technology. So measurement of viscosity is something called CP. If water is 1, a cup of coffee might be 6. The competitors basically can't print above about 25. They can print up to 100 with their own technology, and that, which is effectively like printing motor oil. And they've just done a technology licensing deal, which was announced yesterday with a German company, which will allow them to print up to 400 CP. So very, very, very interesting part of the market. Look, this is all about whether or not the new products they launch are going to be commercially successful. If they are, the volumes are likely to be substantially higher in the next 5 years than they are today. They've just put lean manufacturing in the factory, and which we think will add quite materially to gross margin. Ultimately, what should the business make? High teens margins.
Right, okay. Yeah, you'd have thought so. With high IPR, it's always been sort of promising high margins, you'd expect. Okay, well, good work in progress on that one.
Yeah, and again, it's the only independent one left. Everyone else is Japanese conglomerate or US conglomerate.
Yeah. What about XP Power that does sort of like, it's a Singapore-based sort of power converter. I'm guessing it's benefiting from electrification of all things, sort of like, you know, AC to DC and moving things around, you know, this sort of stuff. What's your sort of latest view? Makes good margins, actually. Operating profit, about sort of 15, 16%.
Yeah, so it should be more.
Okay.
Yeah, it should make about 20% margins. Again, this is another company that's been caught up with the supply chain issues about getting product. Look, where it differs from the power converter that maybe goes between the plug and your PC, what it does is power converters for much lower volume applications where there's a need to semi-bespoke. So it might be that it has to go in, I don't know, a machine in a hostel where there's no electrical noise, where it's not standard voltage, so it's not 9 volt or 12 volts, it might be 14.7 volts for whatever reason. So it's quite an interesting business. End markets are so healthcare, general industrials such as test and measurement machinery, and also semiconductor.
Yeah.
The order book is very strong at the moment, and way above what it's been for quite a long time, and it will start to eat into its order book. Market got a bit concerned about two things. Number one, they'd geared up quite a bit last year, and they had a legal case found against them, which was much more punitive than they thought. Now that might be reduced, but everyone's taking worst case scenario on that. The debt's got quite high. We think actually the debt won't be a problem over the medium to long term.
The management team sort of, that's one of their objectives to pay down
get down. And the company's very cash generative.
Yeah.
So the second issue is concern about the semiconductor industry. You know, there's a perception it's boom or bust in terms of CapEx. Now, their view is, number one, the order book is massive. We're not seeing any particular deterioration or degradation in orders coming through. Number two, if you look at what's happening in the CHIPS Act and the reshoring of semiconductor manufacturing in the US from Asia, there's going to be several years of very strong demand there. So actually, actual volumes of manufactured semiconductors are quite weak at the moment, but it's likely that, you know, sentiment will improve towards the stock towards the end of the year.
Yeah, there's huge capacity brought on stream in the fabs, isn't there? So
they've got they've got to kick them out. And you know, the TSMC facility in Arizona, the last time I met the management team, it said everyone's built the factory. You know, Biden went down there and what have you. There's nothing in it.
Yeah, you're right. They've got to basically put the equipment in there, haven't they? And I know Intel are doing the same, and I think Infineon are as well. And so, yeah, there's plenty going off. Now, another one, which is the old VTech business, Videndum. Now, obviously, you know, as we've opened up the economy, people have probably, you know, they were recording their home videos and posting on and upgrading with cameras and buying stuff from the old VTech business or Videndum. Now that we're going out more, that's probably been a bit of soft spot. But there has actually been, I did notice, has been a sort of like a writer's strike out in Hollywood. And now there's an actor's strike, actually, as well, for film producers.
Oh, yeah. I don't know if you know, there's a director's strike as well. Everyone's been striking. Yeah, look, it's really unhelpful for this business. And I think, you know, we've owned a small bit of this in the fund for some time. We traded it quite well last year, sold half the holding, having made quite well. You know, this has been, I think, quite unfortunate. And on top of that, what they were really struggling with on the more consumer side of the business was destocking with their customers. In fact, actually, when we saw them quite recently, they showed us pictures from some of their customers with shelf edge labels of their product that was in the customer's store, where the customer had never actually ordered the product.
Right.
Because they didn't want to take more inventory on because they're worried. So this is in a bit of a perfect storm at the moment. It has quite a bit of debt at the moment, although very cash generative. They have traded through before. They have part of the business they can sell, which is a non-core asset, which I think could bring debt down. I think it's in a short term, it's in a bit of a tricky situation. Long term, as we've talked about before, it's quite often the dominant provider in all the niches it's in. In some cases, it's got 10 times the market share of the next guy. You know, I think for long term, I think it would do very well, but there's quite a lot of short term uncertainty there.
Yeah. And just broadly, in terms of companies which are indebted, et cetera, how do you sort of like put them into the sort of they should be okay bucket or the difficulty bucket? Is it sort of like they're looking at term structure and when they have to refinance that debt, or how do you actually view it?
Yeah. So look at terms, look at covenants, look at the need for capex or otherwise in the business, the asset backing. So again, everyone was very worried about Elementis 3 years ago. And we thought the asset backing was more than about almost potentially double the debt. So that company will always get banked by somebody. If you've got an industrial company with lots of depreciating machinery with no other buyers of the stuff, you know, that's quite a bad, that's not as good a leverage prospect. So we look at the underlying assets. It could Spy Hostels owns as a freehold, you'll always get debt for that business. So you know, we look at that, and then we consider we consider what's a reasonable amount of debt. And we also look at the shareholder register as well. You know, if the company needs to raise a bit of equity, who else is on the register? Will they and can they fund a bit more of an equity cure as well? And sometimes these situations can be pretty interesting. So you might lose a bit of money and get the balance sheet slightly wrong. But if you put money in at the bottom and maybe take above your shareholding from people that can't follow your money, you make a really, really good return on the equity financing.
Yeah.
But it has to be a good business. You know, there's no point in going to an indebted company that's a bad business.
Or nowadays you put in convertible debt at 10% and make hay while the sun shines.
I think refinance can be very good. We made lots of money in 2009, finally good companies with bad balance sheets.
Yeah, good. Well, in 6 months' time, I'm going to ask you again, Stuart, what your view is on the Thames Water, okay? You have to tell me about that one balance. It's only 14 billion, apparently.
I'll leave that one to you, Paul.
Easy one to refinance. Just going full circle, Finelight. Dial-A-Light, which does sort of industrial LED lights, etc. Now, again, the margins are quite tight, about 4% operating profit margins. I was just wondering what sort of attracted you to this one in terms of USPs or growth or whatever.
Yeah, I think it's another really good example of a company that should and could be doing, we think, much better. Mm. And we think it should be making double digit margins, you know, yeah, pretty comfortably. There's been this has been hit by supply chain issues as well. They gave a really good example of one of their semiconductors. Normally would have been $1 or $2. Mm. When things were very tight last year, they were having to pay $30 or $40 for some of these semiconductors. And some of the distributors wanted $100 for some of them. So there's been all this supply chain problems, and the company had a choice. Either they take a margin hit and supply their customers on time, mm, or alternatively, they don't and they lose share. And they went for share gain, which was painful in the short term. There's been quite significant board change there as well, quite recently, since we last spoke. And two new non-execs, particular note, a guy called Neil Johnson has gone in. And I think in the annual report, it states that a number of shareholders were keen to promote Neil to become chairman. Mm. Neil has a fantastic track record of turning around small mid-cap companies, particularly in the electronics sector. And there's another non-exec John called Steve Blair, who's the senior non-exec. And he actually was chief exec of a business that Neil turned around as well, a company called ETV Technologies, which I was a big investor in. We think Fix, this business, should be making more than 10% margins. Mm. And it's a small player in a big global market with lots of gorillas around.
Yeah. Well, as I say, again, another one, if you get sort of a heavyweight management team who have done it before, then with that sort of track record, then they know which levers to pull to get the business back into shape. So, good potential upside. And just more broadly, in terms of how much cash does the Odessian Capital sort of fund have? And where are you looking, sort of like, if you do have any spare, where are you looking to deploy? Don't tell me any stocks, because I know you can't, but no. In just terms of sort of sectors.
We're short of cash and long ideas at the moment.
Okay. Well, that's because of what you were saying. There's really good value in that whole area.
I mean, we've looked at a couple of stocks and we thought, actually, we really like this company that we don't own. We think we might make 3x on it, but we've got no cash. So
right,
are we going to sell a company we think has got 100% upside to go and put into a company that's got 200% upside? Yeah. Now, that's the conundrum we've got at the moment.
That's a nice problem, though.
It's frustrating, though.
Yeah, no, I mean, I know, yeah.
You've had some of our peers like Richard Penny, et cetera. I mean, the general view is our market is really unloved and hated at the moment. Yeah. But you've got individual stocks like Gooch and James Fisher. Mm-hmm. When sentiment changes from indifference to people want to buy, these things can move very, very quickly. In fact, actually, we're doing our quarterly at the moment. Our weighted average company is trading at half its long-term EV sales and price-to-book ratio.
That's
the weighted average.
Yeah. No, I did look. I mean, you've got this year to date, you've got NASDAQ up 35% and AIM is down 10%. And it's just like so extreme. Crazy.
It's an unusual period. And I think, and these things do change. But I think the thing, you know, it's different for retail investors, but for institutional investors, if quite often you have to buy before the bottom.
Yes.
To get the volume, because once these things turn, you know, Gooch and House go, good luck trying to find 8% of the company now. Mm. You just
I'm with you. You're never going to buy at the bottom, and you're never going to, usually don't sell at the top. But if you can get the position that of significant volume on a down day, then you can live through if it goes further down and then comes back up at a later date. Yeah, I'm with you.
It's and I think the key to the key to avoid is basically companies that have bad balance sheets where they don't get rescued and they're bad companies. That's where you get killed. And, you know, other things generally recover.
And I think another bit of good news for Odessian investors is that, given the quality which you've bought, I'll be stunned if there isn't any more M&A, and you had a boatload last year. So that should give you a bit more firepower for you and Ed to put into these businesses with multiple X upsides.
Well, we don't bank on it, but what we think is really interesting, the portfolio's got almost its record low exposure to UK economy. We've only got 24% of the portfolio exposed to the UK. The rest is all international.
Yeah.
You know, UK assets are still cheap. We don't see sentiment from trade buyers here at the moment. I think if once we know how bad the recession is going to be and people can price things, if companies' share prices haven't moved, we think it's going to be a lower activity next year.
Yeah.
You know, it feels a bit early now. It's too early now. It might be a bit early Q3, Q4, but I think next year could be pretty interesting.
Well, it's better to be early than to be late, that's for sure. Now, now, Stuart, if people want to put some money into the Odessian Fund, how best to do that? I mean, obviously, I guess the shares are traded, aren't they? So you can...
Yeah, that's right. It's like any other company. Obviously, we'd suggest that people take their own independent advice and look at the appropriateness. But it's a stock trade like any other stock on the stock market.
Brilliant. Okay, well, thanks again, Stuart. Keep up the great work and look forward in asking you about Thames Water in 6 months' time.
Fantastic. Thanks, Paul. Take care. Bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.